Right. Amen. Thank you, Micah. And thank you for moving that for me out of the way so I didn't knock it over. I just kept thinking, I know I'm going to knock that thing over. But thank you, Micah. Well done. Let's take our Bibles and turn to our passage this morning in the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 5. And we'll be looking at verses 1 through 12 this morning. So Joshua 5, 1 through 12. And the title of the message is The Need for Spiritual Preparation. Now, there are a lot of common, ordinary things that people oftentimes make preparation for. There was an article that I read recently that gave a list of some of those more common ones, which are, for instance, emergency and disaster preparedness. We like to prepare in case a storm comes or something along those lines. Financially, in terms of retirement, a lot of times people plan for retirement and those types of things. One of the more common other ones was legal and estate planning with wills and trust, and those types of things. So preparation for things in the future isn't unusual. It's a normal practice. But this morning, I want us to look at something else, a little bit different with preparation. The Lord, if you've been with us the last few weeks, has brought the nation of Israel, in other words, the Israelites, into the promised land. They have crossed the Jordan. And as a result of all of the work of the Lord and all the things that He has done, what we'll find is in the early portion of our verses this morning is that the kings throughout the land are terrified and afraid of the Israelites. And so now's the time to strike. Right? Actually, no. This morning we're going to see that the Lord knows that they need something else in terms of being prepared. They need to be prepared spiritually to overcome what lies ahead. And it will not be a mighty army that wins and conquers the land. In fact, what you will find in the book of Joshua is that the people only succeed when the Lord is first. When He is any other place, they tend to lose. In fact, when we get to a few more chapters ahead, what you'll find is that when they rush ahead and there is no first place for God, they actually lose. And so what you'll see this morning is this lesson on the need to be prepared spiritually. Everything else is second, third tier if we aren't prepared spiritually for what lies ahead by putting God first. We miss out on many of the things that the Lord has for us. If you want to follow along, this is on the back of the bulletin. If you're a guest with us or just need to look at this as we go along. So we'll look at Joshua chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. And we'll see in verse 1, hearts are melted away. This sets the stage for the need for spiritual preparation. And then in verses 2 through 9, we'll see that there's a time for renewal. And this deals with circumcision, obedience. And when they do this, God is going to roll away the reproach, the mocking and the ridicule of the nation of Israel. And I refer to it that as at this point, it is the Israelites. But in any event, then we'll look at verses 10 through 12. Once they are prepared spiritually, then they will be able to observe Passover. And then have you ever wondered when the manna stops? Well, you won't have to too long today because the manna is going to stop. And there's a reason why the manna stops here, just like everything else. God's timing is what? Perfect. And so God's going to cease giving them manna after all of these years, and we'll look at that as we go along. But let's just read these in sections. And so we'll begin by reading Joshua chapter 5, verse 1, get our bearings where we are and why they don't rush ahead of God, at least in this instance they don't. But let's just read the first verse to get the setting of what's going on. Now it came about when all of the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts melted away and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. So we've been using this outline, or I have, and the outline is to give you a look at the book of Joshua from a million feet in the air. So in other words, looking down at it as a big picture, the way Joshua works is God prepares the Israelites, but he also prepares the leader, Joshua. They have been, and today will finish, their entrance into the promised land. In other words, they've passed the Jordan. And then the bulk of the chapter through chapter 12 is the campaigns of the military warfare. This is where they actually take possession of the land. They have crossed the Jordan. Now they're going to take and possess what God is going to give to them, and then they'll divide the land up. And I know many of you are thinking, okay, Pastor, 13 through 21, how in the world are you going to do a sermon series with that? Because all it is them dividing the land. We'll come back when the time comes and I'll show you. But they'll divide the land up, and then Joshua's work is by and large done, and he has these farewell sermons or speeches, we might say. So we are in the point here where they've entered the land. Now's the time to strike, but God says, no, not yet. There's other things that need to take place. Now, if you've been with us, how we arrive where we are in the book, but where we arrive with the Israelites, I use this as sort of a guide. There are four main miracles that occur in the book of Joshua, and anyone want to take a wild guess on the first one? Well, it's the first one on there, parting of the Jordan. We haven't encountered anything else yet. The Jordan is parted by the Lord, which enables the people to cross into the promised land, as we think of, and it puts them in a strategic place called Gilgal. Now, Gilgal is really important to understand, or you're going to lose your bearings and you're not going to grasp why they are where they are so many times there. Now, if you can't see this, this was a really large map here, okay? And it's color-coded and everything, but I do want you to see this because this is really important, because the name Gilgal comes up quite often in the Old Testament, in particular here, and you can see roughly where they are, the Dead Sea, and then you have the Jordan that goes up to the Sea of Galilee, an easy way to know where we are. To the east of the Jordan, that's the area where the three tribes roughly have already taken possession of the land. To the west is where they're going to spend the preponderance of the time conquering. But everybody needs a headquarters in terms of military strategies and things like that. Gilgal, as we see, an easy way to remember is that this is the headquarters while they are conquering the land. Easy way to remember it, because they're settled into the land in due time, but their headquarters is in Gilgal. Now, last week, if you were with us, if you look at Joshua chapter 4 and verse 24, you'll know that the reason for those memorial stones is twofold, if you remember. The first was for the Israelites and the generations that would come after that. In other words, I likened it to parents. We are to teach our children about what? Not the world, but the Word of God and the Lord and the things of the Lord. The other side of the memorial stones, if you remember verse 24, and we get an example of it today. What was the second reason? Notice verse 24 of Joshua 4. That all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that they may fear the Lord God. And when we look at verse 1, you get an example of that. Notice where we read in verse 1 of chapter 4. The kings to the west, in other words, west of the Jordan, what is their response? Well, they heard what all the Lord was doing, and they are what? They're afraid. Just as Joshua 4:24 said, that one of the purposes behind the miracle was to bring fear of the Lord. And again, fear, we tend to gravitate towards the idea of reverence and awe, which is part of that. But fear also means fear. It means to be afraid. We would say in our vernacular, what? Shaking in the boots, right? Both are true when you look at the word. And so that is the idea. So they feared the Lord. Now, I want you to look with me, and this relates to Rahab, because Rahab's story isn't over. We're going to return to Rahab, but I want you to look with me in Joshua 2, because I want you to grasp why they would be as afraid as they are. They already were afraid before they came. Now they really are afraid, meaning those kings of the West. So look at Joshua chapter 2. This is the portion here with Rahab. And again, Rahab's story isn't over. God has blessed and so forth the harlot Rahab. And there was the promise, you remember, of the scarlet cord, which we'll come to in a few messages. But notice when the spies came in Joshua 2 verses 10 through 11. So she's speaking here, Rahab is, to the spies that came. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. Drop down to verse 11. When we heard it, our hearts melted away and we had no courage. They were afraid of what God had done, and they were afraid in terms of the Red Sea. Who wouldn't be? I mean, who would not be afraid if they knew that the Lord had parted Lake Michigan? I mean, you'd have fear, wouldn't you? But then you double it down, and then they have this other miraculous event, which is the parting of the Jordan. So they are already afraid, and they haven't even gone to blows yet. They haven't even begun to war with these people, and they are afraid. The important thing, and I'm drawing this out as I want you to understand, the people do not conquer the land. The Lord conquers the land. If you have ever heard someone teach that the people conquer the land, that is not what the Bible teaches. God is the one who empowers them, and He clears the way. What you'll find is, in chapter 7, Joshua himself rushes ahead and they lose. But then when they follow the Lord in chapter 8, what do you think comes? Victory. It is not the people, it is the Lord, and when they're walking with Him. So that is the whole premise of why He's stopping them here, is because if they're not spiritually prepared, if their house isn't in order, they will lose. But now's the time to strike, isn't it? Look, I know how the church is. We would be, let's strike, wouldn't we? How many of you have been in committee meetings or in a board meeting or something? Yeah, those people are afraid, let's strike. And then we'll get spiritual things right. Not quite. I'm going to read you something here, and I do want you to understand this is very, very important. This isn't just loosely thrown in here. The whole book of Joshua going forward in many ways sets on this principle. Let's just read it. This comes from a Moody commentary, Carl Armington, in his book on Conquest and Victory writes, "From the human standpoint, if ever there was a time to strike at the Canaanites, it was right after the Israelites had gained entrance into the land. Fear had taken hold of the inhabitants of Palestine. But divine plans are not made according to human strategy." That last line is what I want you to see. The people, if they had rushed ahead, would have lost. And all you have to do to get a glimpse of that is chapter 7. It is the Lord in His timing that everything has to be just so. They didn't need to rush ahead. They had their spiritual house and the spiritual aspects of their life had to be taken care of, which is what prompts what we're going to read in the rest of these verses. So let's pick up and read verses 2 through 9. So Joshua chapter 5, verses 2 through 9, because it does seem like the time is right. And the natural inclination is strike while the iron's hot, strike while they are afraid. But it's more important for the people to be prepared spiritually than to have a mighty army. So let's read verses 2 through 9. "At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, 'Make for yourselves flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time.' So Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibbethah-Haraloth. This is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt, who were males, all the men of war, died in the wilderness along with the way after they came out of Egypt. For all the people who came out were circumcised, But all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way, as they came out of Egypt, had not been circumcised. For the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, that is, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not listen to the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord had sworn that he would not let them see the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Their children, whom he raised up in their place, Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not circumcised them along the way. Now, when they had finished circumcising all the nation, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you, so that the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day." Now, as we look here and see again, you would think that you would go forward, wouldn't you? I mean, you've got all these people that are terrified. The army is revved up. They're ready to go. But God has to make sure that they are prepared spiritually. In short, that's essentially what's happening here, before they go into and do what he's going to ask them to do, which is to conquer the land. Now, many times we get confused. What is going on? God told Abraham that he would make him not only have a great name, but a great nation. A great nation needs what? People. Well, duh, it's hard to be a nation by yourself, isn't it, with one person? A nation needs a land. And so God has the people. Now he's bringing them into the land, but they're going to need to do things on his own terms. Now he brings in the subject of circumcision. Why would the people need to be circumcised in order to go into the promised land? It was a prerequisite, we would call it. You know, it's sort of like in school, you know, before you can take class B, you've got to take class A. The people that go into the promised land need to have been circumcised. Now, if you take the Abrahamic covenant, which is Genesis 12, that the name of Abraham would be great, there would be great blessing that would come to him, and a great nation would come out of him. You get to Genesis 15, and it gets elaborated on a little bit. But then when you get to Genesis 17, you have something that is unique, and the uniqueness is circumcision would be a sign of the covenant. In other words, it was a sign of those covenant principles of Genesis chapter 12 and Genesis chapter 15. Genesis 12 and Genesis chapter 15 are the Abrahamic covenant, the components of it. You think of it very simply, what I have up there. Seed, in other words, offspring. I mean, does Abraham have many sons? If not, when we have VBS, we can't sing it, right? Father Abraham had many sons, didn't he? He also needed to have land. You can't have a nation without a land. And then, of course, it would blessing would flow through, ultimately, the Messiah, Jesus. The covenant here is referring to a sign, and the sign would be to identify those individuals that were part of that Abrahamic covenant. So the circumcision would be identification. Paul speaks of the church in terms of being spiritually circumcised, identifying us with whom? Jesus Christ. So that's the idea. It's identification is what this is drawing for. Now, the question invariably comes up, and I put it up there. Second time, I know many of you men are thinking, oh no, once was enough. That's not what it's saying, okay? If you look at verses 4 and 5, when we're reading it, we're explained why it needed to be done again. Now, I put it up there for you, and it's as simple as I can put it. If you read verses 4 and 5, it's explained. I mean, we don't have to make up stuff, okay? There's no need to make up things, because in verses 4 and 5, it says, the prior generation, I call it the Exodus generation, they were circumcised. They go off and they began to go into the wilderness. And during the wilderness time, there was no circumcision being done. And so as you have new people being born of this new generation in the wilderness, they never experienced circumcision. That's why there needs to be another circumcision. In other words, there was the one with the Exodus generation. How long and what happened to that generation? Well, they died because of unfaithfulness, which is what we'll see in just a minute. And so the practice had been neglected, but now, in order for the people to be identified as God's people, they need to observe circumcision, and they also need it in order to observe Passover. Those elements were needed, and so it had to be done another time. In other words, because that initial prior generation, they did not circumcise their children, okay? And so they spent all this time, so you have this new generation that has raised itself up. Now, I want you to be drawn, though, to your attention to verse 6 in case there's any ambiguity on why the previous generation had to die. Notice verse 6 again. The sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all that generation, meaning the generation at Kadesh Barnea that rebelled against God. But why? They perished, verse 6, because they didn't listen to God. Why is that so important, and why does that keep coming up over and over again? It's very simply this. Verse 6 is teaching you that there is consequence to disobedience. The Exodus generation, if that helps you, the prior generation, did they receive what God had for them? No, they failed. And they all died, missing out on everything that God had. And the reason for that, the main culprit, is they failed to listen to God. Now, let me ask you in your own life, have you ever failed to listen to God? I'm sure none of you have. But in the future, when you fail to listen to God, what you'll find is you miss out on what He has for you. And so the idea here is these people never made it to the Promised Land. Have you ever seen one of those maps? They just walk around, don't they? Go around, wandering around. It should have only taken a few weeks. It takes years, and many of them actually never experience it. Whenever we disobey the Lord and His Word, there's always consequences. I want you to look with something with me here, and it seems like I'm getting off on a beaten path, and even if I am, we're going to go there anyway. Turn with me to 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 11, because I just want you to see this. Because in case someone who would say, well, you know, Stephen, that's fine, but God doesn't really do that. You know, He just did it one time. I mean, there's no need to. I mean, God is gracious and He forgives us. What I want you to see with the Exodus generation and Solomon is a very simple principle, which is this. Yes, God forgives, but the consequences can last a lifetime. God doesn't promise to remove the consequence. He may, but not always. I want you to look at this one. This is an interesting one. King Solomon, was he the wisest man on earth? When he did what God said. When he did the Proverbs, he did. But he wasn't always the wisest man, was he? Not at all. And I want you to notice something here, because there is a consequence that he will not be able to undo, even if God forgives him. David, when he went in with Bathsheba and he committed that sin, God forgave him, Psalm 51. But the consequences remained for him the rest of his life. There is forgiveness, and then there is the removal of consequences. We're not always promised the latter. But this one is a very strong one here. It's verses 7 through 10 of 1 Kings 11. And I want you to see here, because this is a very strong judgment that falls on the wisest man on the earth. But Solomon was only wise when he did what God told him. So this is the section here where Solomon had all of these wives who were foreigners. And then in verse 8, and I'm going to sum this up a little bit for time, thus also he did for all of his foreign wives who burned incense. So he begins to offer sacrifices to foreign gods. Now, do you think God would forgive him? Sure. I mean, God is gracious and he forgives. But I want you to notice here verse 11.